Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
It's the Brian Lehrer Show on WNYC. Good morning, everyone. And the Trump administration may suffer its first casualty any time now. Beltway media are reporting that National Security Council Chairman General Michael Flynn has fallen out of favor for a variety of problems, most seriously, including a possible lie to Mike Pence about Flynn talking to a Russian official in December about possibly lifting sanctions, just as the Obama administration was imposing them for hacking the DNC. Flynn said he didn't even discuss the topic. So he did talk about sanctions, and it could soon be one member of the most radical wing of the Trump team down. But there are still the Steves. And after Steve Bannon has been soaking up most of the scrutiny until now, yesterday it became Stephen Miller's turn. Miller is the very sharp-tongued 31-year-old policy advisor and speechwriter for Trump who got the nod to be the one going on the Sunday talk shows yesterday and make the case for the travel ban and the new immigration raids with the same chip on his shoulder style that we've come to associate with Trump himself. Here is maybe the worst of it, for those of you keeping score at home, on things Trump people say that hint at authoritarianism.
We have a judiciary that has taken far too much power and become, in many cases, a supreme branch of government. One unelected judge in Seattle cannot remake laws for the entire country. I mean, this is just crazy, John. The idea that you're going to have a judge in Seattle say that a foreign national living in Libya has a effective right to enter the United States is beyond anything we've ever seen before. The end result of this, though, is that our opponents, the media, and the whole world will soon see, as we begin to take further actions, that the powers of the president to protect our country are very substantial and will not be questioned.
The powers of the president will not be questioned. The judiciary and the whole world will see. And on that note, we bring in our first guest for today, New York Times White House correspondent Glenn Thrush, getting more famous by the week thanks to Bobby Moynihan playing him on Saturday Night Live, and Jennifer Rubin becoming more famous by the week for sheer force of persuasiveness in her Washington Post blog called Right Turn, Jennifer Rubin's Take from a Conservative Perspective. Hi, Glenn. Hi, Jennifer. Welcome back to WNYC.
Nice to be back.
And coming up, we'll replay Glenn's latest 60 seconds, I should say, of SNL fame from this weekend as the recipient of a Melissa McCarthy, Sean Spicer rant. But Jennifer, to begin with the serious before we get to the ridiculous, did you find it politics as usual or more of a break from American democratic norms that Stephen Miller would say things like that on national television yesterday?
Appearance, actually there were four appearances, I think do fuel the sense that this White House doesn't accept traditional views of American democracy and separation of powers. Had he said that the president simply has extensive powers, that would have been perfectly acceptable. In fact, the Ninth Circuit said as much. What wasn't acceptable was when he turned to the position that there is no limit on the president, that he can't be questioned. That was an argument which, remarkably, the administration tried to make, but was soundly rejected by the court and is not in keeping with judicial practice in terms of constitutional law that we've enjoyed for about 200 years. I think that when these people go on the air and they try to impress their boss, they often say they have an audience of one, that they wind up freaking out the rest of the country. And I think that certainly happened again on Sunday.
And Glenn, be patient for a minute, because I want to get through a little material that Jennifer wrote up that I think is really important. I see that your latest major piece for the Post is largely about how Trump as a candidate gave a grouchy electorate the temper tantrum they'd been looking for. But with the same behavior, Trump, the president, shows doubt and uncertainty about democracy itself. How do you think he's sowing doubt about democracy itself?
I think he does it every day when he denounces the court, when he challenges a free and independent press, when he tries to operate by executive order when he takes the side of autocrats internationally. I think his entire ethos is one of a businessman, a CEO who's used to barking orders at people. And it comes as a rude awakening that that's not how our system works. His tendency to eviscerate personally opponents, critics, is not in keeping with our democratic system. This is a system of checks and balances where the minority does get their say, where courts are the final say, not because they're infallible, but because they're last, as the saying goes. And that's not a viewpoint that he wears easily. That's not a cloak that he chooses to don, and it's getting him into a lot of trouble, in part because he has advisors who have never worked in government, let alone the White House. And so they are unaccustomed to how all of this works. And you see the results in court. You see the results from the permanent bureaucracy, if you will, that is now in revolt in multiple departments.
I'm doing a radio hit for the next 20 minutes.
And there is, I think, a sense that the wheels are sort of coming off the bus at this point.
Some of the specifics that your article mentions, his false claims of voter fraud undermine our electoral system, his narcissistic indulgences destroy the majesty of his office, that's how you put it, and his careening foreign policy declarations undermine our allies' faith in the United States, even Australia. What would you say to Trump supporters who argue, no, this is the disruption that we elected him to create? The majesty of his office isn't harmed by the president speaking bluntly and fighting back against his establishment critics. The tough talk on foreign policy, ruffling some feathers, yes, is what we need after ineffectual Obama. And on voter fraud, well, there are some stories that have surfaced of non-citizens getting registered, so let's do a deeper study.
I think it's virtually impossible to argue on the merits with his hardcore supporters because nothing you say is frankly going to affect them. I would say, however, that Trump himself, if any and all of these news accounts, there are a zillion of them this morning, are to be believed, he himself knows that this is not going well. He's upset with his chief of staff. He's upset with his national security advisor. He's upset with his communications guy. This is not going as planned. And although Stephen Miller declared that he's accomplished more in 3 weeks than most presidents have in their entire term, no one really believes that. And I think the proof is in Trump's own reaction to what has transpired. Trump, if you remember, promised to make us respected and restore alliances. Instead, he's made brand new enemies. He promised to get big things done right away. We're nowhere down the road in terms of either health care reform or tax reform, which were his big initiatives. He's gotten sidetracked on all of these issues. So even by his own lights, this is not a success. And I disagree, actually, with critics who say that now his entire presidency is marred, there's no recovery, American politics isn't so simple, and people are capable of enormous comebacks. We sometimes forget that there were rocky passages, not this rocky, but nevertheless rocky passages at the beginning of the Obama administration, the beginning of the Clinton administration, and they went through personnel changes as well. I think it's more acute with this president because of his volatile personality and because we see every inch and every second of this amplified through social media. But nevertheless, I think it is still early. The question is whether he has the moral and temperamental makeup to change his stripes.
All right. Glenn Thrush, you had a Stephen Miller profile in the Times, time for his major debut on the Sunday shows. Here's one more clip of him, shockingly to many people, doubling down on Trump's evidence-free claim that he lost the popular vote due to millions of fraudulent votes. This is on ABC This Week with George Stephanopoulos asking this question.
I'm asking you as the White House senior I'm asking you as the White House senior policy advisor. The president made a statement saying he was the victim of voter fraud, people being bussed from Massachusetts to New Hampshire. Do you have any evidence?
If this is an issue that interests you, then we can talk about it more in the future. And we now have our governance beginning to get stood up, but we have a Department of Justice and we have more officials. And the issue of voter fraud is something we're going to be looking at very seriously and very hard.
And Stephanopoulos concluded that exchange by saying, so far, for the record, you've offered no evidence. Is that consistent with the Stephen Miller you profiled in your piece, Glenn?
Oh, 100%. You know, it's funny. He has a role with a policy portfolio in the White House, but he is actually a polemicist. I mean, he has no policy experience. One thing that really struck me about that exchange, Brian, he cites Chris Kobach, the Secretary of State of Kansas, who's one of the real proponents of the notion that there is widespread voter fraud. I did a podcast when I was back at Politico over the summer with Kobach in Topeka, and I said, lay out the evidence. And he said, and I'm getting my numbers probably a little wrong, is he said they did a 12-year survey of voting trends in the state of Kansas and found at most a dozen to two dozen discrepancies that he could identify as actual voter fraud. So, and then I asked Kobach, because this is a guy that people like Miller cite. Then I asked Kobach, how could that kind of thing swing an election? And his theory of the case was, if you had a tight race in a tight district, that a few false votes could swing the election. Kobach subsequently, when he was up for the job, up for some jobs in the White House, kind of changed his tune a little bit when I talked with him over the summer. So when Miller says this stuff, and by the way, go check out New Hampshire is not a factual defense of an argument. And in general, we've been seeing this a lot with the White House. We've seen it in the legal arguments against the migration order. They don't have a marshaled set of facts to buttress their assertions.
And the Washington Post, and I'm not going to go into the details, but has a very good article breaking down the numbers in New Hampshire and the difference between the votes that Trump got and Republican Senate candidate Kelly Ayotte got, and how they were busing in all these people to vote for one Republican. Why didn't they vote for all the Republicans? Why did they defeat one Republican while electing Trump, these fraudulent voters? But, you know, or the other way.
Wait, look, the one thing I'll tell you about New Hampshire is it's the one state where you could say it's overpopulated by political reporters, right? I mean, everybody's up there covering stuff. We all know the Republican organizational folks, the people on the newspapers and editorial boards. Give me a break. This is a nonsense point. And it's up, you know, he can't shift the burden of proof to George Stephanopoulos right. or anybody else.
So the bottom line here is that rather than restraining Trump from his worst impulses, his senior policy advisor, Stephen Miller, is egging him on. And you wrote that Miller's ascent to senior policy advisor came as a shock to many of the Senate staff members who knew him from his 7 years working for Senator Jeff Sessions. Why was it a shock?
Well, it was a shock because Steve Miller was known among his Republican colleagues as the guy who would send 8 to 12 emails to them a day, full of either forwarding negative stuff about Jeff Sessions' political opponents, but more likely spinning these theories about suppressed American wages as a result of the flood of foreign labor coming from the southern border. And it got so bad. And granted, these are people who weren't inclined to support Mr. Miller's position in the first place. Some Republican staff on the Hill actually set their spam filters to send Miller's missives to spam.
And these were fellow Republican Senate staff members?
Yeah. And remember, if folks can remember, we had the Gang of Eight proposal, which was supposed to be a comprehensive immigration reform proposal. And this is really interesting. There are a couple of figures that I think loom very large in Miller's world and in the world of Steve Bannon and in that general sort of Breitbart alt-right cluster that's in the White House right now. Marco Rubio, the Florida senator, was instrumental in kickstarting that Gang of Eight proposal. He became a target for Sessions and for Miller and for Breitbart at that point in time. And a lot of those emails that Miller was sending out were very negative on Marco. And then the other figure, and this is really interesting, remember Dave Brott, the very conservative Tea Party Republican who beat Eric Cantor in Virginia in 2014. He was part of that as well. Miller was in his mm-hmm. spare time. So, Julia Hahn, a Breitbart writer, and Bannon was involved as well. That knocking out knocking out Cantor and going after Rubio. Those were kind of the formative experiences of this group of people who are now kind of running the West Wing.
So it's that wing. So, Jennifer, for you as a conservative, does it break with a norm in Republican politics that people with explicit views like Bannon's and Miller's are too extreme for the most inner circle of the president of the United States? Normally they would be. Or is everyone so inflamed now that we forget that maybe people from the inner Bush administration, maybe Cheney or Bolton or some hardline people Reagan had way back when, weren't ideologically so different or were hardline for their times?
Fundamental difference between Trump and the people around him, most specifically Miller and the others. In the past, whether it was a Republican or a Democratic administration, there was some effort to get real facts. There was some effort to make policy pronouncement commensurate with reality. They didn't fabricate information. They didn't come up with these loony claims that couldn't be proven. They made policy arguments based upon how they saw the country and how they saw certain problems. Stephen Miller, one of the things that was so interesting, and I follow this minute by minute as I know Glenn did, was that he essentially would take the propaganda and the nonsense claims of eccentric anti-immigrant groups, not just anti-immigration reform groups, but anti-immigrant groups who have their origin in the zero population group phenomenon, groups like FAIR, F-A-I-R, which isn't, and Numbers USA, and the Center for Immigration Studies. And he would sort of take the nonsense that they churned out, slap it into an email, and that would be a lot of what he was sending out and around. And it was amusing to many conservatives at the time because it was some of the same arguments organized labor was using to try to keep immigrants out of the workplace. And this was unusual coming from a senator who is extremely anti-union and also, by the way, extremely opposed to raising the minimum wage, which is another way to protect American workers. Mm-hmm. Really no different than limiting immigration. You're artificially trying to bump up American wages. So I think the fundamental difference, which Miller personifies, is that there is no attempt at intellectual seriousness. There's no attempt at getting and sticking to the facts. They have a vision of the world which, frankly, is unmoored to reality. And we've never had that in the presidency.
How about
we have campaigns run like that. But once you got to the White House, people had some fidelity, some sense of obligation to the truth.
How about Jeff Sessions in this respect through your eyes? I mean, what's going around in the Stephen Miller profiles now in both your papers is that he grew up in liberal L.A., got politicized to the right in reaction to the multicultural education of his high school, which made him feel somehow that the nation was threatened. And when he grew up, he went to work for maybe the most racially conservative member of the U.S. Senate, one Jefferson Beauregard Sessions, with his old South Alabama background. I guess what I'm curious about from your perspective, Jennifer, is as a conservative, I keep hearing Sessions is personally well-liked, even by Democrats. Is he taking us backwards to an old set of racial justice norms that don't represent modern conservatism, or is he getting a bad rap, stereotyped because of his Alabama roots and accent or something, in your opinion?
Well, the definition of modern conservatism, I guess, is up for grabs now. It's not the conservatism I know. It's not the conservatism of, Friedman or of Reagan or of Jack Kemp. It is this new populism that is very xenophobic, very nativist, very anti-immigrant, really has no regard for free market principles whatsoever. In fact, most of what they do is directly contrary to free market understanding, seeks an enormous increase in the power of government. When you see plans for a border tax, when you see him individually haranguing separate businesses, when you see the president advocating, essentially a trade war, it's that set of beliefs of which Jeff Sessions is clearly a proponent. That's why he is so close to Trump and why he was an early admirer that I think has captured for now the Republican Party. Yeah. It is really antithetical, in my view, to what at least Reagan and modern conservatism is about. And that's why people like me have really no party at this point.
Jennifer Rubin from The Washington Post, Glenn Thresh, White House correspondent for The New York Times. All right, Glenn, here we go. Now, listeners, Glenn Thrush has been a star on this show for many years, going back to his days with Newsday, then his time with Politico, now he's with The Times, and suddenly pop culture has discovered Glenn Thrush, as he has come up several times now in the Melissa McCarthy, Sean Spicer rants on Saturday Night Live. Here is the pertinent 60 seconds from this weekend show.
Now I'm going to open it up for questions, and I'm going to probably freak if you start asking stupid ones. Speaking of freaks and stupid ones, Glenn Thrush, New York Times, stupid hat, go!
Look, I just wanted to know what the president intends to do now that the appeals court denied your request to stop the travel ban.
You're testing me, big guy. It's simple. If the appeals court won't do what's right, President Trump will see them in court, specifically the people's court.
That isn't real.
No, that isn't real. Oh, I'm Glenn, and I'm not really.
It is real, Glenn. It says that right before East case, Glenn. It says the cases are real. The rulings are final. Don't F with me, Glenn. Next question.
Melissa McCarthy playing Sean Spicer and Glenn Thrush played by Bobby Moynihan in that clip. Are you surprised to see that it's you out of all the possible White House correspondents who SNL has singled out as the representative of the press corps taking abuse?
I would use the word mortified. Mike, I got to say, this is, you take one for your kids occasionally, right? This is my kids are really enjoying this. In fact, the first time they did this, which was a couple of weeks ago, or well, a week ago, it seems like 10 years, one of their principal kind of snuck into their social studies class. I have twin boys who are in school together. And they, the principal pulled them out, and they both thought they were in trouble. And instead, the principal was like, "This is really cool." So, for that reason, I will take the family hit for the boys.
What's it really like in those briefings? I've been watching them. They've become like cable TV ratings grabbers. Apparently, during the early afternoons, they start about 1:30 or 2 o'clock. And there was a fear at the beginning of the administration, and this is a serious question, that they weren't even going to do White House press briefings. That this administration was so anti-democracy, you know, including the Fifth Estate, that they were just going to talk over the heads of the American people, over the heads of the media directly to the American people only. But Sean Spicer is going out there and taking your questions every day and doing battle, yeah, but there is the real give and take. So what does it look like to you?
Well, it looks like, first of all, I should say, I've known Sean, and I guess Jennifer has too, right, for probably more than a decade. He is a professional, and he's somebody I've had a lot of dealings with. I think first at the National Office of the National Trade Representative when he worked for Bush, and then through the RNC for many, many years. But I think he's in an impossible position because that job has an audience of one. It doesn't have an audience of millions. I mean, we know, my colleague Maggie Haberman reported sort of exhaustively on this. The president watches most every minute of this and calls the guy in afterwards to say what he likes and doesn't like. I think it's an extremely difficult job. The reason I got parodied and picked out was because in one of the first press conferences, Sean said something which was inaccurate about my paper's reporting on the Department of Homeland Security officials expressing deep reservations and problems with the way that the immigration ban was implemented. My colleague Ron Nixon did great reporting on that. He nailed it. He spoke to a lot of people in that agency, and then Spicer came on and literally said our reporting was false. So I'm not going to take that on behalf of my paper, and I think as a representative of the press. So in a polite but firm way, I interrupted him and said, "You're wrong, Sean. That is accurate." And that's when he started shouting my name, which I think is probably what caught the writer's attention. But there's a larger principle at stake here, and that is a room that doesn't belong to Sean Spicer. That is a room that belongs to the American people and belongs to the answers, not the questions. Those are the things that we ought to be focused on. And I do not like the balance of power when the first thing that the press secretary for the president of the United States does with that room is come out and shout at the press, claiming that we mischaracterized the crowd size at the inauguration. And then, by the way, you can yell at us, but then storming off and not taking questions. That is not a room where the questions matter. That's a room where the answers matter.
And then there was doubt about whether he would be taking questions on a regular basis, and at least he's been doing that. I know you got to go in a minute. You co-wrote the famous bathrobe story about Trump wearing a bathrobe at night and rethinking tactics after the early stumbles, like the poor rollout of the travel moratorium. Spicer seemed to take umbrage at the bathrobe being an incorrect detail, and that got a lot of press. But I'm more interested in your suggestion in that story that Bannon wrote the executive order that elevated Bannon to the National Security Council without quite telling Trump what he was signing, and Trump didn't read it carefully enough to know what he was signing. How much can you say with how much confidence about that?
Oh, we have 100% confidence in that. I mean, and by the way, thanks for picking up on the actual meat of the story as opposed to the diversion, because my suspicion was we're confident in all aspects of our reporting in this story. But I felt that the White House was clearly seeking to divert attention from that larger point that you just made. Look, you know, a lot of people interpreted our reporting, I think incorrectly, as us saying that the president had not read the executive order. We don't know whether he read the executive order or not. We've been told that he did. But that's not the point. The point is he was not given the historical context or the operational information to understand why that order was important. I mean, imagine if you, Jennifer, I think she's a lawyer, so she's got a leg up on us. If you just dove into the Federal Register and started reading stuff, you wouldn't really understand the significance of it. And here's what we were told. The president was not told by his advisors, Bannon, Miller, and other people, or Priebus, that this represented a significant change in the power dynamic of the permanent committee of the National Security Council. There had never been a political aide on it in that position of authority, and the Joint Chiefs of Staff, in addition to the Director of National Intelligence, were put in a non-permanent status. That was a serious downgrade. And, you know, the White House denied that anything was done in order to empower Bannon. But it was pretty clear that that wasn't the case. And we were told from multiple sources, and by the way, this has become part of the lore in the West Wing at this point and been reconfirmed by people over there over the course of the last 10 days. The president was aggravated with that and, as a result, empowered Priebus to essentially install the first real protocol for review of these things. So I think it's a telling detail, far more than the bathrobe. The man gets to wear whatever he wants. But I think the question is he surrounded? This is the least experienced president to occupy this office, least experienced in terms of his own interest in governance. Is he surrounding himself with the people who can give him the best information and help him operationalize his populism? Because at this point in time, I think the question isn't necessarily what direction he wants to take the country, but his capacity in terms of moving the levers of government to do so.
Glenn Thrush, White House correspondent for The New York Times. Keep asking those stupid questions in the press briefing. And thank you for coming on today.
Always a pleasure, Brian. Take care.
And we have a few more minutes with Jennifer Rubin, conservative right turn blogger for The Washington Post. And Jennifer, let me get a caller in or two reacting to what you guys have been talking about. Edgar in Jersey City, you're on WNYC. Hi, Edgar.
Hey, Brian, thanks for taking my call. I'm just a little flummoxed because the reality is that I find the kind of counterattacks that people are waging against Trump or someone like Stephen Miller pretty ineffective. And I think the real problem is that we're using this question of evidence and facts. I honestly feel sometimes when I listen to the media that are against Trump, you know, and I'm actually against Trump, very against him, I feel like I'm in a seminar on the Enlightenment. As if evidence and facts are the key thing in a populist right-wing nationalist mobilization. They're not. That's a myth system you need to create. And it just seems like a lot of the stuff on MSNBC, on CNN, even on our beloved NYC, is almost, you know, you're clutching your pearls at the opera while your coach driver is freezing, you know?
The opposition is one thing, and we're going to do a separate segment later on the resistance. But what do you want journalists to do besides present clear facts and context?
I think journalists need to go beyond journalism. They need to start thinking about, and they always have, in fact, that's the truth of the matter. They're not empirical scientists. They're not just presenting facts in some kind of value-neutral way. That's never been the case. That's an ideological sort of cliche. I think what we need to do is engage in polemic and political fighting. The thing with Stephen Miller, I saw all his you know, sort of his shows. when he was on the talk shows on Sunday, he looked like a troubled working class kid who's fighting elites. And guess what? That really feeds into the Trump base. They're like, okay, the kid's taking it on, and he's yelling at them, and he's having a bar fight with them. Good. And who's George Stephanopoulos? Some old hack from the Clinton administration.
Yeah, I thought I was the only person to watch five Sunday shows because I have to. Well, you raise an important set of questions. Jennifer Rubin, I mean, you have a position of columnist, so you can express your opinion in ways that people on the, you know, in the regular news hole don't. But what do you think about, you know, Edgar's larger critique of the place of journalism?
Well, I would invite Edgar and all like-minded people to come read The Right Turn Fraud, because there's plenty of polemics there. And what I do try to do is address these sorts of larger questions about truth, about manipulation of truth, about how right-wing populist movements try to obscure the truth. And I think there is a place for that. I think there is a difference between what I do and what Glenn Thrush does. That's why there are editorial pages, and that's why there are news pages. I still do some reporting, and I think Glenn will acknowledge that in the analysis, point of view does play a role on the news side as well. But I think it's a mistake.
And I said, and when I replied to Edgar, facts and context, facts doesn't mean he said versus he said.
Correct.
Right? Context means, you know, a robust attempt at getting to the truth through analysis of all the facts. And if the facts aren't kind of even on one side or the other, then a good news report is not going to wind up as a kind of 50-50 bland nothing.
And I think to your point, coverage has changed because of that. They have given up on that he says the moon is made of green cheese, and this person says it's not, because it is deceptive. When there is one side that is actively lying, making up stuff, it's not a he said, she said. It's a he said something that wasn't true, and they know it's not true. And I think the coverage in that respect has changed. I do think it's a mistake, a serious mistake, however, to abandon facts and reason. That is the ally of totalitarians. That's always been the gameplay of people who seem to want to control the media, who want to subvert dissent. They want to be the ones who say, don't believe your lying eyes, believe us. And I think it is a form of resistance in and of itself to insist upon reality. We saw this in Poland during the Cold War. When the Pope came and when Solidarity was organizing, they would hold up signs that said 2 + 2 = 4. And what they meant by that is, we believe in an objective reality. We don't believe the lies that the communist regime has been spoon-feeding us. And it was a powerful moment. Objective reality is actually a friend of democracy. It's how you hold politicians accountable. It's how you marshal an argument to make a debate. It's exceptionally important. So the way I look at it is, depending upon whether it's a Monday, a Tuesday, a Wednesday, some or all of my readership may not believe in the facts, but it's my obligation to put it out there and to honestly, from my point of view, interpret that. I do want to go back, though, to one thing that Glenn said just before he had to leave that is really important. He made the observation that there are people around him who are not telling Trump the context. He is absolutely right, and we saw this during the transition on the call to Taiwan. He essentially was set up by aides. He took this call. No one thinks he was briefed on the One China policy. No one thinks he was told what the implications were. And in fact, now they've had to reaffirm the One China policy because it was never their intention to abandon it. What you have with a president who is so ignorant, who is so unprepared, is you have a lot of entrepreneurial showboating and manipulation by aides who are not elected to make this decision and who are trying to buffet the president one way or the other. That's a dangerous situation, particularly when those people around him are people like Stephen Miller.
One more call. Jules in the West Village. You're on WNYC. Hello, Jules.
Hi. How does Stephen Bannon get a security clearance? And if Flynn falls, does Bannon rise?
What's your security clearance question based on?
Well, he's on the National Security Council. He must have a clearance.
Go ahead, Jennifer.
there's a lot of question, not only about how he has the clearance, but how Michael Flynn continues to retain him, his, given all of the investigation that's going around. We don't know the particulars, but to be honest, the president can give people a clearance if that's what he wants them to have. There's not a judge that's going to adjudicate that. I think from the outside, we can all, just as the caller did, raise concerns about what are these people doing in these settings, and really, why does Michael Flynn, who's been shown to either have lied or have an awful memory about his calls with the Russian ambassador, how does he retain his clearance? How does he retain his clearance when we know during the transition he was representing Turkish interests and Russian interests at a time he was receiving a classified briefing from the White House? These are real questions, and you have seen in those last few days a number of Democrats raising these issues, wanting to get to the bottom of it. And if we had a more independent mind Congress, you'd have the security, the intelligence committees in both the House and the Senate looking into this very question, because it's a serious one. The caller is exactly right. When you have people who are compromised, who are involved in goodness knows what, you do run a security risk. And there was a quote, I believe, either in Glenn's paper or my paper, I apologize for not recalling, where a national security type was quoted as saying, "We believe that the Russians hear everything that goes on in the Situation Room." That was a remarkable statement, basically saying that they are so compromised, either because they have people they don't trust or because for what other reason, that we can't even have a classified briefing, a classified discussion in the Situation Room of the White House without it going back to the Russians. That is scary.
And on that, we leave it with Jennifer Rubin, who writes the Right Turn blog for The Washington Post. Jennifer, thank you very much.
My pleasure.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC. A lot more to come today, including we will look, now that we've looked at what the Trump administration is doing, we'll look at what the resistance is doing and a lot more, too. Stay with us, Brian Lehrer on WNYC.